Yo, what is up, lacrosse world? This is the In the Crease podcast. I'm Dan Abern, and I've got Kyle Devitt on the other end, and I cannot fully believe it, Kyle, but we are on to Foxborough. The Final Four is here. Championship weekend.
Yeah, I'm still confused by the crowd at the Merrimack game, knowing all the words to Blink-182's All the Small Things last night. And, you know, I slept like trash, but we're out here, so let's get this banked.
Quarterfinal weekend Saturday was awesome. Sunday, not so much. We'll get to that. Let's start breaking down the first game of the quarterfinal weekend. We've got Yale beating Loyola 8-5. The Pat Spencer versus Ben Reeves show lived up to the billing, Kyle. I actually really did enjoy the matchup of All-American attackmen against All-American defensemen immensely. This game had a really fast start, and it looked like it was going to be a real shootout. And then the rain came down in Hempstead, New York. It was bad. And the game got slow. But Reeves definitely showed out. He had Tewaratan caliber play in this game with 3 goals and 3 assists.
I think it was apparent early on that Yale needed a game from Star. And after being critical of his play the last few weeks, you know, I have to admit that he delivered. You know, he wasn't spectacular, but he did the job. On the defensive end, Yale tried to make Spencer beat them as a dodger and a shooter and never let him get too comfortable behind the cage. And I think that's how teams will elect to play Spencer next year. But also other teams won't have Chris Fake. You mentioned it earlier. Who do you think won the Reeves-Spencer showdown?
So I think Ben Reeves won, obviously, with 3 goals and 3 assists. You can easily point to that. But I do think that Pat Spencer played well in this game, and they didn't really have the ball for most of the game. And I felt like with the opportunities that he had, Pat Spencer did play well. But obviously, we'll get into this a bit later. We're talking Tewaratan and Player of the Year. Playoffs really matter, and Ben Reeves showed out in the moment and really was a big difference maker in a very low scoring game. And it was kept really low scoring because of Loyola goalie Jacob Stover. And after a really rough start, he settled in and played out of his mind. Like, he finished with 18 or 19 saves, maybe the greatest performance by a Stover for a Baltimore team ever. And Charlie Toomey said after the game that Stover's performance was, quote, one that was wasted, and that it was the most disappointing thing that they couldn't find a way to win, given how well he played.
With the way Yale was spinning the ball, you knew it was going to come down to Stover to make big stops. I just think that the Loyola D looked less and less fresh as the game went on, and listen, Yale was bombarding them with shots. Obviously, we talk a lot about Reeves, but the Elias have plenty of other contributors. Jackson Morrow, who had 3 assists here. You know, Mike Gaudette, who's the definition of the crease monkey finisher. Yale doesn't wow you with this super athletic dodging crew until they drop down to attack where Reeves is. What they do is they poke and they prod at you like some evil genius doctor just trying to find the best way to make you talk. You know, the offense is really just, it's a torturous beauty to behold for people that love watching great offenses.
And another thing Loyola just didn't do well in this game was play clean. They did not play a clean game, failed a lot of clears, including 6 in the second half. And it just felt like they didn't have the ball for long periods of time in the game. You know, props to Yale goalie Jack Starr, like we mentioned. I thought he probably had the best game of his season with 9 saves. Like you said, not spectacular, but delivered a performance that they needed in order to win. And Connor Mackey, just tremendous. 17 of 21 draws won in this game. I would love to see the possession numbers throughout this contest, because Yale had the ball a lot, and I don't think Jacob Stover gets to 19 saves without such a tremendous possession deficit and absolutely getting bombarded throughout the game.
I don't know about you, but I voted Connor Mackey as my third team faceoff man, and I had to think about it for maybe 20 seconds. Erland and Baptiste have the dominant skills, but Mackey comes to the X with this giant metal toolbox full of counters. And I think he did a tremendous job for Yale all season, and more specifically played a huge role for them in the playoffs. And now they're in the semis. I mean, shout to Mackey. He did a great job.
Kyle, you know what they didn't have in the press box at Hofstra? They had a lot of food, but you know what they didn't have? Trimino. Let's give a shout out to our sponsor, Trimino. Protein is an important part of any athlete's diet. Supplement your protein diet without excess calories and fat by going with Trimino protein-infused water. Trimino goes beyond hydration. It's got protein and B vitamins to sustain your game. It has 7 grams of whey protein, no sugars, no carbs, no fats, and only 28 calories. I mentioned this on the podcast last week, but we are dead out of Trimino at the office. It's going like hotcakes. We've got to get some more. You can get Trimino at CVS, local retailers near you, and always on Amazon. Protein never tasted so good. All right, Kyle, time to thump our chests because the Dane train is going to Foxborough. Albany 15, Denver 13.
Yeah, man, it's you know, it's too bad you turned traitor last week and back Loyola. People don't forget. People don't forget, Dan. It's fine. Maybe you can squeeze into the last club car, sit on someone's lap, something. The rest of the train is full up and, as you said, headed to Foxborough.
I think people forget. I just don't think you forget, Kyle. You did forget, though, that I'm duct taped to the front of the train. But seriously, though, what an amazing game. Possibly an all-time tournament game for me. It really did live up to the billing. Both coaches admitted that after the game. The matchup at the Faceoff X lived up to the hype, and it was, in the end, for me, a huge testimonial to wing play. It was a worthy battle. I thought TD Ireland came out of the gate really hot. I think they won the first 3 or 4 faceoffs. Baptiste adjusted in the middle of the game and started winning a lot of clean draws to himself. But like I said, this came down to ground ball scrums after the initial draw when we look at the full entirety of the game. I wish they kept a stat like checks that prevented a ground ball, because I feel like the wings for both teams would have had a ton in this game. And the split was 50-50, but there's no doubt in my mind that getting to 50% is a major victory for Albany. I don't think they win without getting there, because I know that I thought, and I think a lot of observers thought, that Trevor Baptiste would win 60 to 70% of his draws in this game.
I mean, it was certainly the most tense I have felt watching a D1 game all season, although I still think that the Wesleyan RIT D3 semi was better overall, but I get that you would never stoop to such a level as to watch a Division III game. I mean, how dare I think that? Still, the way that Tohoka delivered here was the highlight for me. I mean, he played with an edge that I don't think we've seen a lot of throughout the season. He was out there being a real one, you know, throwing bows and pushing guys off his teammates after hits. I mean, you can't do that without repercussions. And we saw it. You got a flag thrown on him. And, you know, Denver had an opportunity here, but luckily Albany was able to get a key stop, get the clear, and, you know, secure the win.
Yeah, you spoke about Tohoka. I thought it was just a really very impressive offensive display from Albany overall. You know, we were talking throughout the game that they needed to continue to find success in early offense in order to win this game, and they did. They kept capitalizing off of fast breaks, early offense. And then I also thought they got a ton of big unassisted goals, particularly from Kyle McClancy. I think he had 2 in the last 5 minutes of the game to kind of give Albany that edge that they said, all right, we're really going to do this. And then Justin Ray also had a few unassisted goals. Like you said, Tohoka showed up in a big way in a huge game and did some stuff that had me grabbing my hair in the Hempstead press box. I was blown away by some of the stuff that he was doing. And then I think perhaps most importantly, Connor Fields didn't need to be the star of this show. I thought that was big. He had 3 assists, but he had their second defenseman on him. Didn't have as many touches as you might expect. Dodged a few times, looked okay on that knee. But I think with the way he can be limited with this knee injury, the other guys stepped up in a big way in this game, and I just thought that was so big.
So the thing that bothers me is everyone repeatedly saying how Fields is playing on one leg. He's not playing on one leg. His leg works. If his leg didn't work, he wouldn't be playing. Maybe it's not, and it's not maybe. It's definitely not what it was. But he's still changing direction pretty well, and he always did that move where he feints right and then rolls back with his uninjured leg anyway and goes to his left. I think that key part of his game is totally unchanged. And also, Albany's using him differently. You know, he's not an initiator. He's the guy making the pass. He's the fulcrum. You know, he is the guy hitting the guy who maybe doesn't take the shot but makes the next pass to ensure an easy layup. You know, he's got another week to heal. It's been months, plural. I mean, Danny Logan was wearing a knee brace. Was he playing on one leg? I didn't hear anyone talk about that. Just got ridiculous after a while hearing the same thing. And listen, Fields is kicking ass regardless. I just feel like saying he's playing on one leg is like reaching for a dirty cookie on the floor. Like, you don't need that cookie, man. Just let it go. Let it go.
Yeah, you make a good point that just because he's wearing a knee brace doesn't mean he can't play up to a certain level. I don't think he's 100%, but let's be real. I think he's playing a lot better than I think both of us thought he would when he first went down and then went down again in the Yale game in the regular season. Defensively for Albany, let's talk about them a little bit, because I thought Stone Sims did a really good job of limiting Ethan Walker's opportunities in this game. I think he only had one goal, maybe three shots. The midfield stepped up. Colton Jackson could not miss in this game. But overall, I thought Albany's defense did a really good job of neutralizing that very potent Denver attack. Kyle, let's move on to T-shirt pitch of the week. Thank God the season's almost over, because we can shelve this segment. Do you have something for me, Kyle?
Yeah, I mean, while we're here, I'm just going to stump for my D3 Life shirt, hashtag D3 Life. We're out of pitches. Pitches get stitches. But if I think of one before Saturday, I'll definitely put it on Twitter. For right now, you can go to insidethecross.com/store or /shop, as we found out on a previous pod, and purchase the hashtag D3 Life shirt, because I am very excited for that championship matchup, Wesleyan and Salisbury, next weekend.
Yeah, I actually have a rare recommendation for a t-shirt. I got a pitch, Kyle. So I think we should have a shirt, or maybe a set of two shirts. One that says, Annapolis should be the permanent home of championship weekend. And either on the back or on another shirt completely, it says, but graduation though. But graduation though. Because, you know, 13,000 people showed up in Annapolis. We're going to talk about these games next. A great atmosphere. It always seems to get a good crowd, especially when you feed schools like Maryland and Johns Hopkins into the matchups. But if you want to have Annapolis as a permanent destination for championship weekend, like they do in NCAA baseball with Omaha, you're going to have to move the season either forward or back. I don't think forward is a good idea at all, so we'll have to move the season back, because graduation is always Memorial Day weekend for the Naval Academy. They use that stadium. We can't use it for lacrosse. That's your solution. But I do like that t-shirt idea. Speaking of Maryland, Kyle, they are once again going to the Final Four. They beat Cornell 13-8 in the first quarterfinal in Annapolis. First and foremost, before we delve into either of these games, I gotta say, Sunday's game stunk so bad compared to Saturday, in my opinion.
Oh, good. So I made the right decision to turn off both games when Maryland and Duke were ahead by 3 goals, because I just didn't see a way for the other team to come back into it. Also, I don't know if we mentioned this, D2 and D3 semis, pretty lit, pretty great. I'd rather watch those. And I did.
I do want to say we did watch the D3 semis in the press box. We had a stream going, and I thought both games were crazy. And the thing I love about D3 is that they make Division I scenarios look so much more insane. Like, Wesleyan was up 17-11 on RIT in the fourth quarter, right? And RIT had like a 6-goal comeback that they just made out of thin air. Nuts, man. D3 is wild. Let us talk about Maryland, though, because they face guarded Jeff Teat in this game, and they initially went with third defenseman Jack Welding because he was reportedly one of their better defenders against lefties. But Maryland changed up the matchup throughout the game, got both Bryce Young and Curtis Corley on him at various points. And Jeff Teat was a non-factor. He had 17 total touches in this game, 2 assists, 1 shot, and no goals. And I want to point this out because I thought Ryan Boyle made a really good point on the break between the two quarterfinal games when he said that teams are face guarding Jeff Teat because I think that they know that they can face guard him. And more so, Cornell really didn't do enough to get him the ball in this game. It kind of seemed like they were helpless. I think teams know that Teat isn't the caliber of athlete that can shake off a defender who is face guarding him. Like, imagine if we talked about the possibility of teams face guarding Pat Spencer or Ben Reeves. We'd be laughing because we know that those two guys are capable of shaking off a defender and getting open. It just felt like if they weren't getting Jeff Teat the ball off a restart, they couldn't get him open otherwise.
This is the thing that other teams couldn't do. You know, Maryland didn't sacrifice one of their top-tier defenders because they have guys with size, speed, and athleticism to spare. They packed in the defense, played extremely tough on ball, and had really good rotations. That backside look that Cornell constantly manufactures with great ball movement only got past the Terps a couple times. And you could tell that the bulk of the big red shots early on were powered by pure frustration. I'm going to ask this because someone has to. After seeing Teat in the playoffs, was the committee right to leave him off the ballot? Like, if you can get shut down by a dude who is just bigger and faster when you're supposed to be this Messi-like magician with the ball, do you deserve to be considered one of the best players in college lacrosse?
So I think that's a fair inquiry. But yeah, I saw a lot of people say, oh, Jeff Teat is not elite because he can't get the ball if he's being face guarded. And you can't be an elite player if you can't do that. And I understand that. I think that is a fair argument. But whether or not the committee should have left him off because he kind of had some stinkers in the playoffs, I don't know. Maybe they were right in thinking that, but let's be real. They definitely look good in this scenario because he had these stinkers. Like, if he had back-to-back 6 to 10-point games, they would be looking like idiots. Speaking of Toraton finalists, Cornell's Jake Pulver did a really good job limiting Connor Kelly in this game. I think Kelly had, like, 1 goal, 3 shots. But Jared Bernhardt came out of his slump with 3 goals and an assist. And then Bubba Fairman just turned it on. He's been really great for Maryland for the past couple weeks. 13 points since the Big Ten tournament started, and then 5 points in this game. A career high for him. Definitely the best performance he's had in his young career for Maryland. Anthony DeMeo had 2 goals. And then let's not forget Justin Shockey, the freshman faceoff specialist, who went 13 of 19, and Cornell simply had no answer for. I think they started pulling him in the late stages of the second quarter.
Framerman was the most impressive to me. I just thought his ability to get free of his defender and then make the finish look easy, regardless of whether or not that defender was a short stick or a pole, was something that we only saw flashes of all season. And Framerman playing with confidence going into championship weekend should scare a ton of teams. Like, that is a ridiculous proposition to deal with him, Kelly, Bernhardt, and Rotance. That's nuts. I'd be worried.
Yeah, and I know that one of the criticisms aimed at Maryland was that they had no depth of scoring outside of Connor Kelly and Jared Bernhardt. But in this game, I think they proved that that just isn't true. I think they've got so many other guys that can hurt you. Tim Rotans is a guy who, if he gets a short stick, he can score. Bubba Fairman, I think, can prove that he can initiate off a short stick and beat a pole as well. Anthony DeMayo coming off the bench had two big goals. I think, you know, teams will still do what Cornell did in this game, and that's try to take away Connor Kelly. But if you don't have two great defensemen that can temper the two-pronged attack of Kelly and Bernhardt, it just opens up so much more for the complimentary scores for Maryland. We'll say, I'm not surprised that Bubba Fairman went off. He's a guy, if you watch him on the recruiting circuit, made plays like like plays he made in this game with regularity. But I think, you know, he took a postgraduate year. He's more physically, technically mature. But we also saw this in the game we're going to talk about next. But there's a few freshmen who may have been a little bit quiet to start the season, but they played a lot of minutes and they're starting to finally find their feet in big moments like this. Kyle, next game, Duke 14, Johns Hopkins 9. Whew, yeesh. So my major takeaway after watching this game was that Duke looked so much more athletic than Hopkins did throughout most of the game. The broadcasters pointed it out, but it just felt like every physical matchup was being won by Duke. Then again, something just seemed off with Johns Hopkins, because it's not like they don't have athletes or guys who could run with Duke. This game was close for most of the first quarter, and then the Blue Devils got two goals late in the later stages of that quarter, and it was at that point that I knew that it was going to be an uphill battle all day for Johns Hopkins. But again, I just thought it was athleticism that may have been the difference here. At halftime, 6 of 7 of Duke's goals were unassisted, and think about some of them. Joey Manow just running past a short stick, scoring in the final minute of the first quarter. Brian Smythe winning a faceoff and running all the way down for a score. Riley Walsh ISOing from behind the cage, scoring on a jump shot. Then Prendergast, a D-middy, sweeping to the middle, smoking his defender and getting one past Turnbull. It just looked like Hopkins was shell-shocked by how fast and how strong the Blue Devils could strike.
Super glad that I skipped most of this one. I did see, you know, part of it, and early on I saw that Duke was playing that inside rotation with their attackmen, but also getting Hopkins' best defenders to press out. And I just thought, yep, that's how you do it. Good or dang, good or done.
Yeah, Hopkins looked very off on the offensive end, like I said. Maybe a little rattled by how aggressive Duke's defense tends to come out on you. They did get some looks on the interior throughout the game, but sometimes Hopkins dropped the ball, the defense collapsed on that person, or Danny Fowler made a save. I thought early on Fowler was a big difference maker, making stops on a few good looks for Johns Hopkins. And then also Hopkins just did not start the game shooting the ball very well. They shot very poorly early on. But they did make it interesting late in the game, rallying to get within one goal in the fourth quarter. But for every Hopkins run, Duke had an answer. You know, in the fourth quarter, Nekhi Montgomery made two big plays for them. He's a freshman for them who has played on the first line and has also gotten a lot of shifts on the second line as well. But in this game, he was pretty much featured on the first midfield throughout the game. He's a freshman who, like Bubba Fairman, has got his minutes under his feet and is starting to play with confidence down the road in the big moments. And it felt like Duke answered with so little work, while Johns Hopkins had to overcome so much to score. And when they pulled within one, I thought, all right, maybe this could get interesting. And then just Duke did what they did the whole game and just had a quick strike, scored two goals really quickly. And it's at that point I was like, this is just too much. Like, Hopkins just can't overcome this athleticism, this quick strike offense that Duke has. You know, I thought going into this game that specialist play would be the difference maker. And when you do look at the final stats, I think that is apparent. Brian Smith, I think, went 18 of 25 at the faceoff X. Pretty much, you know, took it to Hunter Moreland in that faceoff unit for Johns Hopkins. That has looked really good for large portions of this season. Then Danny Fowler came up with a huge early start, played well throughout the game, bested Brock Turnbull on the other end, who quite frankly, if he didn't have as good a game as he did in the first half, it could have gotten really ugly for Johns Hopkins. Kyle, moving on to Tuoratone Watch. This is a playoff award, so let's delve into it.
So our next segment is pretty popular. It's the Tuoratone Watch. I mean, Dan, who is left? We have Reeves, Gooderding, and Kelly. I mean, this is now a playoff award, so make sure you take that into account, because the dude that gets to the championship game and has the best stats is going to win. Or if Yale loses, the winner of the Duke-Maryland game, the guy on that team will get handed the Tuoratone Trophy on the sideline before the championship game even starts. That's just how it's going to go, guys and gals. I hate to be the one to break that to you, but you know, this is a new award. This is a new dawn. It's playoff award.
Yeah, sadly, Baptiste's chances, I think, were pretty much eliminated with the loss, which really stinks because he is a talent that we may not see ever again. I do think T.D. Yearlin has a chance to break some of his records, though. I will say that. Besides the point, I think Reeves' stock really shot up with his performance against Loyola, as did Justin Gutterding's. He scored 3 goals, and in doing so, passed Zach Greer's all-time goal-scoring record, which, to be perfectly honest, kind of snuck up on me and kind of came out of nowhere. I still think this award goes to whoever goes the farthest. I think you're right. If Yale loses, the winner of Duke-Maryland, Connor Kelly or Justin Gutterding, will win that award.
I actually think we should create our own playoff award. I don't know, call it like the Frank Urso Trophy or something. Just for the best player in the playoffs. Like, why don't we get that? I'm MVP of the playoffs. It's boring. Let's make our own committee. Let's make our own award. Let's see where it takes us. Yeah. I think it's going to do well.
We should do like our own award. The should have won the Tuoratone Award. I think if we could even go and retroactively select players who should have won this award. Like Paul Rabil, back in the day, should have won. Trevor Baptiste will win that award this year. We can go back and do it every single year. There'll be like one guy would like, but this guy really should have won the award. But yeah, that's how it works. It is a playoff award. I know we've watched a ton of lacrosse, and it sounds like you've probably watched a lot weirder lacrosse than I have over the past couple of days. But let's go Weird Watch of the Week. What do you got for me?
Yeah, it's no secret. It's been a rough go for me as of late. So for my Weird Watch this week, I went back to my roots. You know, got caught up on one of my favorite guilty pleasure shows. It's so preposterous and so great at the same time. It is CW's The 100. Now, I know. It's a CW show. Kyle, why are you, a grown-ass man, watching CW shows? Hear me out. Do you like post-apocalyptic thrillers? Do you enjoy nonsense sci-fi word prattle? How about battles with dirty barbarians that have made-up cultures and societies based on a fusion of old technology and wacky religion? Do you like clans? Do you like cults? Or do you like villains so good that they eventually must be turned into heroes by the writers? How about a strong female protagonist? How about a core story that's actually all about survival and not just killing zombies or warring with people because you're a little baby man that can't take anything seriously or make a decision and constantly yells, "Carl, Carl." Yo, Walking Dead sucks. Stop watching it. PSA. The 100 has all of those great things. And actually, I think there is a zombie in there somewhere. But The 100 is the show for you. 4 seasons are on Netflix. The 5th season is airing right now. The 1st and 2nd seasons are legit super entertaining. But they do have a downward and very depressing downturn. However, the current season is back to its original greatness. I'm happy to have a fun show about the apocalypse that I can enjoy after an extremely successful stressful lacrosse coverage season. You know, give it a try. The first few episodes are rough, but stay with it and you'll be rewarded. That is The 100.
I actually have to say, I am intrigued. There will be an emptiness after Memorial Day Monday, and I will probably look to Netflix to fill that void. So I don't have as much of a weird watch as you, but one thing I do want to mention is that it is almost the season, Kyle. And by that, I mean Bachelorette season. Really excited. What I'm really the most excited for is that they have One of Us featured as the Bachelorette. Well, half of One of Us. They've got a writer from Pro Football Focus as one of the male contestants. Of course, he was a quarterback in college, so he's only half, you know, kind of like an analyst journalist, but I'm really excited for what he's going to bring to the table, man. Kyle isn't about it, are you? Kyle, we've got to give a shout out to our friends at Sideline Swap.
Yeah, this is actually the best time of the year to go on Sideline Swap if you're looking for college gear, because all those seniors, they're throwing it up there and their prices are a little crazy, but I think they'll learn and they'll drop it and things will be really accessible in around like June, July. But go now and check it out. There's definitely other deals to be had. Sideline Swap is where lacrosse players buy and sell their gear, shop helmets, heads, shafts, and gloves for up to 70% off, or snag hard to find college or pro gear. And all purchases are backed by Sideline Swap's buyer guarantee. Head to sidelineswap.com. That's SideLineSwap.com, or download the iPhone app today.
Kyle, let's delve into what maybe everybody is hoping for in this podcast. And that is our predictions for how the semifinal games are going to go. Our final four, Yale, Albany, Maryland, Duke. Actually, the top four teams from our face-off yearbook. Five of these teams were in my top five in the preseason poll. And it feels like then, as it does now, that the Final Four features perhaps the most complete teams in the country then and now. Let's delve into the first matchup, the 12 p.m. game, Yale versus Albany, a rematch from the regular season that Yale won pretty handily. But I think it's going to go very different from that last game. I think after besting Baptiste that the Great Danes will be feeling confident going into the rematch against Connor Mackey, who got the best of them in the regular season game. I think the game plan is the same. Don't let TD Ireland's opponent physically dominate the X and make the faceoff a 50-50 ground ball battle. Likewise, I think Stone Sims did a really good job against Ethan Walker in the quarterfinal game, but he has got his work cut out for him again with a red-hot Ben Reeves as his opponent. Offensively, I think we've got to see another performance like we did where Connor Fields doesn't necessarily run the show and the other guys step up. They also need to can their shots early against Jack Starr and get him feeling pressure, because otherwise I think Yale will do their thing, dominate possession, score a lot of goals, and run them out of the building.
I think Albany is going to play exactly the same way they did against Denver and try to get them to run. I think Yale is going to do the exact same thing that Denver did, which was try to slow the game down and finish any chance they get in early offense. I think the mistake that teams make with Albany is that they're so concerned with controlling the tempo that they don't realize that by focusing so much on that aspect, they're missing the real battle on the ground. If you can rough Albany up off the draw, if you can be really physical with them, including Ireland, and then also get back to the hole as fast as you can, then you can stop almost half of what Albany does best. Don't try to run with them. Try to out-muscle them. Yale is actually tailor-made to do just that, and actually did that in the first game where they faced each other in the regular season. So I think for Albany, they really do need to score in their chances and keep manufacturing those chances and have multi-shot possessions, not goal, goal, goal. I think they need to take multiple shots and bleed a little clock and maybe just get control of the offensive set. And also, you know, they need stops. But I do think that JD Colarusso is easily the best goalie left in the field. And I think that's going to go a long way. Teams with great goalies do well on championship weekend. That's It's kind of a no-brainer.
All right, Kyle. You're excited for the Yale-Albany matchup. I think I'm perhaps more excited for this Maryland-Duke semifinal, because I'm going to be real. The sport has missed this matchup. When I was growing up, when I was playing in high school, Maryland and Duke in the ACC, they would play like one, but up to three times in a season, and each game was a dogfight. One of my first games I ever covered for Inside Lacrosse was a Duke versus Maryland 1-2 matchup. When Duke won yesterday, I immediately threw it back to the 2011 semifinal between these two programs. That game featured two notable moments for me. The first was Maryland laying huge hits on Duke, and they were like both within the same minute, within the first 5 minutes of the game. And then later on in the game, Grant Catalino faking a pass, face dodging his defender, and then canning a shot while waltzing through his defenders. I expect nothing less from this matchup that we're going to get between these two teams on Saturday. The game's going to be intense, full of physicality and emotion. Could see it going either way. And, you know, I think when you... what I just said had really nothing to do with matchups or tactical breakdowns. I think this is a game where you kind of just throw out the record books and say, hey, if anything's going to lead to one team tipping the scales in their favor, it might be specialist play. But this game's just going to be back and forth. I think this is a pick 'em.
I'm so excited for Yale Albany, and I'm just so uninvested in this. It could be a regional thing, judging by your points. I think this is going to be an 8-6 game. The game-winning goal is going to be scored with 10 minutes to go in the fourth, and that's going to be it. You watch. I think this is all about matchup play. Who can stop Connor Kelly? How does an entire defense guard Gutterding, Robertson, and Manone? P.S. Welcome back. Joey Manone, everyone. I think how Duke uses Brad Smith will also be interesting. I think for Maryland, they run him out of the box and they keep him low to get switches on picks and maybe get an invert. For Maryland, it's more about protecting the crease and not allowing those aforementioned goal scorers any room to breathe near Morris. Because if they do, they're going to score. And, you know, Maryland has shown, you know, this Cornell game aside, a little bit of a weakness protecting the very middle of the field for Morris.
All right, Kyle. Our final segment before we close this one out, the Adam Sherlambidez Play of the Week. And I think this week it is a no-brainer. And it is the Tohoka buzzer beater at the end of the first half in Albany's game against Denver. Like, how, dude? Eating through bodies and checks and scoring with no time left. He almost did it again at the end of the third quarter, after catching a Gilman pass from the goalie one-handed and then streaking towards the goal. He unfortunately got trail checked before he could shoot it, but I almost lost it when he did that. I was like, he can't do it again. Oh my gosh, he's going to do it again. I just can't handle this moment. When he didn't, I was like, phew. Okay. It was incredible. That was one of the best goals in the entire season for me.
You know, I have to say, it was an incredible finish. I saw some great plays during the D2 and D3 games, and I would nominate any number of RIT's goals during their fourth quarter comeback that fell just short against Wesleyan. But in terms of an individual effort, Tohoka's goal was pure poetry. I mean, I can't think of another player in college lacrosse that could soak that many checks on their body and the stick and still get the shot off in the air. It's just incredible. He's an incredible player. We're watching history, you know. I think we're gonna be talking to our kids about stuff that Tohoka does from here on out.
I mean, you're absolutely right. I'll be like talking about that quarterfinal game for quite a few years, and let's be real, it was much needed. Given the context of the whole weekend, I would say at least two of the games were not as interesting as we hoped they would be. But after last year, man, when every single game in the quarterfinals seemed like a really one-sided affair, that game was a breath of fresh air. also a breath of fresh air is the teams that we have in the Final Four. Yale in there for the first time since 1990. The Dane train, the first time ever. I know that they are fired up. There's going to be a lot of purple, a lot of Albany chants up in Foxborough on Saturday. I'm super excited about it. I know you are too, Kyle. But that is our show. We are really excited for Foxborough. If you like the podcast, please tell a friend. Please subscribe. Please leave a rating. If you want to give us feedback, you can find me on Twitter at Dan_Abern. Kyle, where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at TheKyleDevitt. You know, like Dan said, leave us a rating on iTunes. It any little bit helps. You know, we really appreciate you guys listening to the show. And we will see you in Foxborough. It's going to be fun. I'm looking forward to it. It's almost over, Dan. It's almost over.
It's winning season. Thanks, guys. Yeah.